Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston Specifica Radio, listener-sponsored commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is also syndicated, and it airs on other radio stations in different states in the U.S. Today on Arab Voices, we will have three segments. First, we will air a podcast produced by the Electronic Intifada titled Gaza Physicians Brace for Impact: How Can Healthcare Workers Prepare for COVID-19 Pandemic Under Siege? After that, we will listen to a new poem by Dr. Fadi Jouda on the coronavirus pandemic. And last but not least, we will air portions of an interview I conducted a few years ago with Dr. Dawood Khairallah, attorney and professor of international law at Georgetown University and the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, who passed away last week. During that interview, we talked about the foreign intervention by the U.S. and other countries in the Arab uprisings in the Middle East. The Electronic Intifada produced another podcast last week titled Gaza Physicians Brace for Impact: How Can Healthcare Workers Prepare for COVID-19 Pandemic Under Siege? At the time of the release of the podcast, there were two cases of COVID-19 in the besieged Gaza Strip. But as of March 31, 2020, and according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, there are now 10 positive cases of COVID-19 in the Gaza Strip. Let's listen in to Gaza Physicians Brace for Impact: How Can Healthcare Workers Prepare for COVID-19 Pandemic Under Siege? A podcast by the Electronic Intifada.
In Gaza, those three pillars of a response to an infectious pandemic like this, not one of them is intact. We're not talking about small holes. We're not talking about manageable defects. We're talking about a complete absence of all of the things that you require to deal with a problem like this.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. My co-host, Asa Wynn-Stanley, is off this week. I hope all our listeners and readers are staying safe and are able to stay inside during this coronavirus pandemic. The first two cases of COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus, have been confirmed in the Gaza Strip, one of the most densely populated places in the world. The Electronic Intifada's Tamara Nassar reported on Sunday that a health ministry official in Gaza announced that the pair had recently returned from Pakistan and were already in quarantine when diagnosed. Both patients were transferred to a field hospital in Gaza's southernmost city, Rafah, where preparations for potential coronavirus cases have been made. All those who came into contact with the patients have been placed in compulsory quarantine. A third Palestinian in the occupied West Bank town of Salfit, who attended the same conference in the Pakistani town of Raiwind near Lahore, also tested positive for the virus. This brings the number of confirmed cases in the occupied West Bank to 57, two in the Gaza Strip, and approximately 1,000 in Israel, where one death has been reported. There are currently about 1,200 Palestinians in 18 different quarantine centers in the Gaza Strip. While the West Bank is on lockdown, compounded with the lockdown of the Israeli military occupation, 2 million Palestinians confined by Israel in Gaza for the last 13 years are facing the crisis amidst a deliberate diminishing of Gaza's health system capacity, while Israel has continued to prohibit vital supplies from entering the territory. Israel bans the import to Gaza of a long list of so-called dual-use items, which it claims may have military purposes. These include medical supplies like glycerin and hydrogen peroxide, which is used as a disinfectant. Israeli rights group Gisha is calling on Israel to suspend its blockade on Gaza and allow all necessary items to enter. We're joined today by our good friend, Dr. Tarek Loubani, an emergency room physician in London, Ontario, who regularly works inside Gaza and is the co-founder of Glia, which makes 3D printed stethoscopes and tourniquets in Gaza. Glia is now turning their attention to making face shields for physicians in Canada. Also with us is Raiden Garapuk, a medical student and the communications director of Glia. They both join us from quarantine in Ontario. Thank you both for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
And thank you so much, Nora, for having us.
Yes, thank you.
So, Tarek, the last time we had you on the podcast in May 2018, 2 years ago, you had been shot in the leg by Israeli snipers while you were treating patients and other physicians during the Great March of Return protests. You talked about the dire lack of emergency field medicine supplies due to the Israeli siege and how physicians were forced to improvise. You're back in Canada now helping Canadian doctors and nurses figure out how to improvise during this pandemic. But you've still got your eyes and ears on Gaza. Even with the quarantine that Gaza's health ministry has set up to the best of their abilities in one of the most densely populated places on the planet and with few basic medications and supplies, what could happen if the virus were to spread in Gaza?
The way I look at it is that dealing with a problem like this consists of three major pillars. There's diagnosis and identification. There's protection of the healthcare workers, the front line, and there's treatment of the patients. Now, in Canada, we have some problems here and there, holes that need to be plugged. And even though all we have is a few problems here and there that need to be plugged and can be plugged, we're still facing down the most major healthcare crisis in Canada easily in a generation, if not in a century. In Gaza, those three pillars of a response to an infectious pandemic like this, not one of them is intact. We're not talking about small holes. We're not talking about manageable defects. We're talking about a complete absence of all of the things that you require to deal with a problem like this.
Can you illustrate that a little bit for us? What are your colleagues in Gaza talking about right now? How are they even able to prepare without any of those abilities to prepare?
Let's talk about the diagnostic aspect first. Until now, there have been, I don't remember the exact number, but over 3,000 people quarantined and only about 100 people who have been tested. In Canada, the numbers would have been probably the opposite of that, 100 people quarantined and 3,000 people tested or something like that. You really expect that if you're going to fight an infection, you have to see the infection and you see an infection with testing. When we were in Gaza, which was just a few weeks ago, we already were aware of patients who were possible, maybe even probable COVID infections, and we weren't able to test them in a timely fashion. In Canada, we can get these tests within 24 hours now, and there are tests that are coming out that are even faster, within 4 hours. In the Gaza Strip, the tests were taking a minimum of 2 weeks. So these patients who were identified, these two people who were identified as being COVID positive, they were in quarantine for 2 weeks waiting for their results because they were probable cases. That means that for those 2 weeks, people didn't take the precautions that they should have. Yes, you can tell people that they should assume everybody is positive, but when you've got 2,000 people in quarantine, you really can't do that every moment of every day. So we really want to narrow the haystack and identify the needles, the dangers. Once you're talking also about that situation, let's say if you told me, okay, Tarek, I want you to be very careful when you go and see this patient. With what personal protective equipment? What gowns am I supposed to wear? What gloves? I mean, when I was there, I was barely finding enough gloves to make it through my shift. It was very routine. It is very routine for me when I'm in the emergency in Shifa to wear one glove at a time. And each patient gets one glove and I try my best not to touch the patient with my exposed hand. That's the reality of personal protective equipment. N95 masks, I don't think I've ever seen one in the Gaza Strip. I'm sure there's some somewhere, but I've never seen one. And things like face shields also absent. You know, is Glia Gaza going to make face shields? Probably, sure. But how does that fix the other personal protective equipment that's missing? And then let's say you identify these patients, and let's say you had the personal protective equipment that you need. The last pillar is treatment. With what are you treating these patients? The two medications that may have some efficacy, azithromycin and hydroxychloroquine, aren't really available there. And they're not going to be available in the quantities needed anytime soon. So we have a problem there. The oxygenation that you can try to get people, well, we don't have enough oxygen concentrators. Ventilators, forget about it. Ventilators are really, really short and are very unlikely to be something that can help in this case, because to run a ventilator, you have to have a place to put the patient who's in a ventilator. We've done such an amazing job getting the intensive cares in Gaza sorted out with solar power. But once you exit the intensive care because of a surge, where are you supposed to put these patients? What building are you supposed to put them in? And how is that building going to be able to ventilate them? Even as far as I know, that Rafah hospital isn't solar powered. So if they ever end up in a situation where they need to ventilate some of these patients, they're just not going to be able to do it. Most countries have problems in one or more of these pillars that are minor. Gaza has disastrous problems in all three of them.
Tarek, what about people at home in Gaza with, you know, a shortage of basic supplies like hydrogen peroxide? How are people supposed to disinfect their homes and you know, their supplies?
This one's probably not as bad as it seems. This is a virus, so it's not some kind of like zombie super force. It's just a virus. Yes, it's going to kill a lot of people, but that's not exactly how it's going to do it because of a lack of things to clean houses with. Really, realistically, washing with soap and water and scrubbing down floors and doors and all of that stuff with soap and water, warm water and soap, is going to be sufficient. So I think we should recognize the dangers. Yes, we need things like hydrogen peroxide, but hydrogen peroxide, largely speaking, is not going to be the main thing that helps us disinfect. That one can easily be worked around in Gaza because Gaza has lots of soap, and even though it's polluted, lots of water that they can use for that type of cleaning.
Let's talk about Glia project right now. Glia is addressing the emergent need for supplies. Doctors need to protect themselves while treating patients, including masks. Are your colleagues in Gaza able to 3D print these supplies yet? How are you working with your colleagues there?
In terms of what Gaza is doing right now, they have the technology to figure out what their needs are and start trying to address them. They are the ones actually who suggested and gave us the first prototypes of the face mask that we're using in Canada now. So clearly that's a product that they're going to go forward with. However, right now it's unclear as of yet where Glia Gaza can be the most helpful. Yes, stethoscopes will be a part of it because you don't want to be sharing stethoscopes or using stethoscopes on multiple patients. Yes, face shields will be a part of it. But frankly, right now, I think it's a little bit too early to say where we can be the most help. One of the things that we've been doing is trying to develop protocols to use things that are already there and be able to clean them. So for example, in Canada, we receive disposable N95 masks. And even in Canada and the United States, in Washington State, people are reusing these masks multiple times over multiple days or weeks. In the Gaza Strip, every mask that enters, we should consider it basically as good as gold. And so if we can give the healthcare providers in Gaza a way in which they can disinfect their N95s, it will reduce the number that they need to bring in. We already know there will be a shortage. We already know they will not be able to enter enough. So giving them ways to extend and expand their use is going to be key, I think, in the next stage.
Raiden, you're a medical student working with Tarek at GLIA. Give us your assessment right now on the situation inside hospitals in Canada and how you're working with doctors, nurses, and other med students around the world through this project.
So right now, with it being at the beginning of this development, there's a lot of prioritization on keeping individuals who are currently outside of the hospitals and working in the healthcare field very healthy and ready to step in if needed. So right now, medical students have very adapted curriculums, very adjusted rotations to ensure that we right now are staying healthy, staying safe, and staying ready. So should the need arise, that would be when medical students would start stepping in the hospitals, whether that be with screening of potential cases, working in satellite sites with the populations outside the hospital to also do screening and assessments, or actually stepping into the hospital to begin working where we are best needed. So as of right now, it is a more outside approach. We have a lot of medical students that have actually stepped up to start caring for the children of healthcare providers that are working long hours, to work on doing grocery runs for different healthcare providers who may not be able to do that right now with their hours, and working outside the hospital, staying safe and a little bit more distance until the time comes that we need to be called in and work in the roles that we're best suited for and best able to help.
And what lessons are you taking into your future career as a doctor after having worked with GLIA and doing this immediate hands-on work, getting supplies into the hands of physicians?
Something with GLIA that has actually come up a lot for me personally, as a medical student entering the field and also someone who worked with GLIA, is the concept of disposability. So healthcare in Canada right now, we have this idea that a lot of PPE is kind of used once and then throw away. And that might be the best thing for our safety, is in case it gets infected, there's this idea that that can become a vector and the PPE itself needs to be disposed of. One of the things GLIA tries to address is the idea of reusability. So if we create these PPE that can be reused safely, that can be sanitized, that can then be, the lifespan can be prolonged, it's going to be lower cost for hospitals, but it's also going to protect the healthcare providers to the same degree, and it's going to help the environment. So this pandemic, as it is now, is really pushing the healthcare system to look towards the future and see what needs to change. And I think GLIA is in a great position to bring this option to the table and really both support and challenge the healthcare system to think bigger, think better, but also look to how we protect ourselves, how we create equipment, and how we can get that out to everybody in the long term.
Tarek, the WHO, the World Health Organization, has been very clear. We need to test everyone and isolate. But states are failing to act quickly enough. What's your advice to people in Palestine, in North America, in Europe, around the world who are facing this pandemic? And speaking as someone in the United States myself, have governments who are completely incapable of providing or unwilling to provide basic care or relief to people? What's the best thing we can do at this point?
There really is a bit of a prisoner's dilemma here, because if a small portion of the population is behaving very selfishly, it will destroy and damage everybody else. And that's one of the things that we see happening, where some people, for example, even in London, Ontario, decided on St. Patrick's Day, which just passed, to go out and party. Those people, they're going to take what they get from those parties, the viruses like COVID, and they're going to take them back into their communities, to their families, to their parents, to their friends, and in turn damage the society as a whole, even if they themselves are okay. In terms of how Palestinians can adapt, right now, I think the messaging has to be very clear. But the messaging is less go wash your hands and socially isolate, because those, if people could do that in Gaza, they would do that. They're piled one atop each other. The messaging really in Gaza has to be brace for impact. We know that this place is a powder keg. We've just watched the spark. If this one doesn't take, the next one will, and eventually the place is going to blow. I think people in Gaza, people have seen what happened in the West Bank. And they think to themselves, if this is happening in the West Bank, which is less dense, which is in lots of ways richer and more capable than Gaza and less blockaded. Obviously, the West Bank is not some kind of Shangri-La. They are still under occupation. They are still blockaded, just not to the same extent as Gaza. And the people in Gaza think, if this is what's happening to them, then what will happen to us with systems that are even more degraded? There's also a sense that you can declare a ceasefire or you can surrender when it's the Israelis. But you can't declare a ceasefire and you can't surrender when it's a virus. And I think that's the thing that's bothering me and bothering lots of my colleagues the most. Once this goes, once that powder keg blows, there isn't really going to be a stopping it. And I'm not one to appeal to Israeli self-interest here, but I think the Israelis, probably their more intelligent planners, fully realize that this kind of unfolding, unchecked coronavirus epidemic in Gaza is going to have very serious repercussions in Israel as well. So, which they also can't stop. They also can't surrender. They also can't ask for a ceasefire. And that's why it behooves everybody on all sides of Gaza, that's the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the Egyptians, who are the junior partners of the occupation, to really join hands and try to make this work for everybody's sake.
Finally, Raiden, can you give us some more info for people, maybe physicians, healthcare workers around the world who are really interested in finding out more about Glia and seeing if they can 3D print their own personal protective equipment, PPE?
Of course. So that is one of kind of Glia's goals moving forward, is, of course, being open access. These codes are available to everyone, and the ability to print this equipment is invaluable in a lot of places, not only in Canada, but throughout the world. The best place for either healthcare providers or other parties who are interested in doing this would be to access the website, which is glia.org, so GLIA.org. And from this website, there's a tab that says work with us. And anyone who's interested can not only find here on this website the access to all the codes, but also how to set up a printer, how to get involved, how to reach out to Glia and figure out, you know, where can I get involved? How can I be a best use? And also other parties that you can offer to support as well. So that, I would say, would be the best point to reach out to. We have an incredible team, a wide variety of different people, both in engineering, in medicine, and in promotion. And everyone's happy to help and ready to answer any emails if anyone has questions. But I would definitely recommend glia.org for anyone that's interested in learning more and possibly getting involved.
Thank you so much. That's Raiden Garapik and Dr. Tarek Loubani. Thank you so much for all the work that you both do and for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
And thank you so much, Nora, for having us.
Yes, thank you.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Dr. Fadi Jouda, Palestinian-American physician, poet, and translator, who won an award from the United Kingdom for translating a collection of Mahmoud Darwish's poems into a compilation called The Butterfly's Burden, and was also winner of Yale Series of Younger Poets competition, who lives and works in Houston, released a new poem on the coronavirus pandemic. Let's take a listen.
Corona Radiata by Fadi Judah. The rats are invisible. The bats are beautiful. Here's the livestock and fish market, and there's the Institute for the Biologic. We're ravenous. Our hunger travels in fueled suitcases packed with desires. The virus is real, gave up its passport, stops for no officer save immunology's guards in epidemiology's tribe. For decades, millions die every year from TB, poverty and malnutrition, attrition, pneumonia, diarrhea, millions the count of Spain's, England's, or Italy's population, annually wiped off the earth, untouchables outside history, and though their geography be diverse, it's short of total. The pandemic is real. If hospitals are overwhelmed, the virus will add to the otherwise preventable deaths and lawsuits. Diabetes, heart disease, kidney failure are bread and butter, colonoscopies too, and organ transplants may be placed on hold. People, there is no human system for this sort of pandemonium, and there won't be unless Echo is one. But if so many die in a single season, what will happen to life insurance firms? If 1% of Americans die in one swoop, what will become of grief? What if rent and mortgages, utility bills, phone and car payments, student and small business loans are waived for a month? Pardoned? What if CEOs give up their salaries for 8 weeks so that the faucet drips the tub full with buoyancy for all? The virus is indebted to no one. Distances close in on us. The curve and the herd and this much death on our soil. Antibiotics, globulins, gloves, masks, and numerator to denominator as yin to yang. If we're lucky, when the virus returns, it will be wearing less imperial clothes. Every 2 minutes, a child dies of malaria. Infomercial, how many minutes in a year? Malaria lyses more than the blood of children and their mothers. Extreme measures against the virus should be taken. This pandemic, one sorrow, one love, this pandemic hangs on a strand of the helical tongue. This pandemic brings me back to Eros and to hysteria's translation in the mind. Pleasure evolved out of life inside life, wanting no more than life itself. Then things got sweet, complicated. Evolution has some capitalist features, yet isn't capitalist, and we know what else evolution isn't. We've been unimaginative of late, since we've run out of land, but not out of real estate. The virus teases us with the bliss to come after detention is served. To hold the estranged, to touch strangers, an ecstasy worth waiting for. And our detention is the earth's respite from our jets and flus and wireless energy. A little rest, not for long. So, extreme measures, why not? Have you been displaced by war? scattered by wind, tattered by abundance? In the last 14 days, have you experienced the endemic flare-up like a bad knee, immobilizer bad, a migraine in the dark? Extreme measures, healthcare a human right, an infrastructure people, culling of militaries, monopolies, but who'll go first? 20 million Iraqis ravaged for generations, 20 million Syrians and 20 million Yemenis, and the curable after excision with clear margins. The virus doesn't speak, doesn't want to be written, doesn't give voice to the voiceless or pay low wages to the lowly. And the looting, always the looting. This kind of talk is part of the problem, not the solution. Still, as a friend said, amidst all this uncertainty and concern, the camellia in my garden is glorious and serene in the knowledge of spring. Far and near, the virus becomes our alibi to obey more in sickness and in wealth. Far and near, the virus awakens in us a responsibility to others who will not die our deaths, nor we theirs, though we might, but must direct our urgency to the elderly, our ancestors who are and aren't our ancestors. And to the compromised. The virus won't spare the poor or the young or anyone with an architecture primed for ruin. This August, the quarantine on small joys should lift. 15 years ago, this August, I came back from Darfur to Hurricane Katrina. It was mostly Anderson Cooper on TV. In Gaza, the virus breaches the siege as document of science and will not exit. Israel offers to track the virus on cell phones of the infected, a treasure trove. Does economy lament? Is it an individual or a corporation? Can it repent? Can capital grow catatonic or speak Chinese? What is avarice with God or without? Let's not say the virus is blaming the patient. Lacking objectivity, these words don't dismiss progress, the sample size, who'll analyze the data, or who'll get the bailout. Without people, there's no power over the people. How much for a mosquito net? $3 a year per person if the swamp isn't drained and heaven's mouth isn't shut? During the carving of the Panama Canal, during penicillin fungating in shrapneled limbs, during smallpox and sex, what if a pandemic kills far fewer than other non-pandemic ailments? The panics in the pan, and vaccines are real. An organism lives to reproduce its servant, master, and host. We're all equally small. And after survival, which shall not be pyrrhic if measures are enforced, surveillance will multiply, careers will be made, grants will be granted, a depression aborted, attenuated, and a call to papers. Spend a penny, save a dime, invest a nickel, make a quarter. The birth rate exceeds the mortal wound. Our overlords will return us to our dreams of forgetting. And our lords, who aren't in heaven, give us this day and lead us not, but deliver us and the pulverized. If they're still warm, if light enough for the breeze.
That was Dr. Fadi Jouda, Palestinian-American physician, poet, and translator, reciting his new poem on the coronavirus pandemic. Thanks, Fadi, for sharing this with our listeners. You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Dr. Dawood Khairallah, who was an attorney and professor of international law at Georgetown University and the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, passed away on March 22, 2020, in Fairfax, Virginia. In 2012, I had interviewed Dr. Khairallah live on Arab Voices, and in his memory, I will be airing portions of that interview now, where we talked about the foreign intervention by the U.S. and other countries in the Arab uprisings in the Middle East. Let's take a listen. Joining us now live via phone is Dr. Dawood Khairallah. He is attorney and professor of international law at Georgetown University and also teaches at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He was deputy general counsel at the World Bank, where he acted as legal counsel to several board committees and also as chairman of the Conflict of Interests Committee. Dr. Khairallah, welcome to Arab Voices. Thank you. We're pleased to have you on the show. Dr. Dawood, the Arab uprisings apparently or and obviously has been a history in the making over the past year and a half. How is your view overall of what has taken place so far?
Probably, if we are to look at the environment that led to this uprising, we see governments in the Arab world is probably distinguished by a huge gap between ruler and ruled. There is hardly any ruler that represents the aspirations, the interests of the ruled in any Arab country. So a clash was bound to take place. Now every movement that has started all over, starting in Tunisia, with Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, all over in the Arab world, people wanted more participatory government. They want to be involved in the government. They wanted a rule of law. They wanted mostly to fight corruption and overcome this problem that plagues most, if not all, Arab societies. So these were the aspirations of the people, and this were and continue to be legitimate aspirations. But unfortunately, those who started these uprisings did not belong to organized political groups, that is, political parties with the clear visions of the problems, clear visions of the solutions, with widely spread organization and popularity among the people, that they could mobilize their people and pursue their objectives and reach the purpose of these uprisings. There were people who really complained of existing conditions, unbearable conditions, but without much organization. And probably the history, the human history, is the history of organized man. So it was very easily hijacked, this uprising. There were forces that objected to the change at the local level. There were forces at the regional level, the Arab level, that feared the democracy and the rule of law. Look at the conditions of the Gulf states. Can one imagine that Saudi Arabia and Qatar and other Gulf countries, who became the champions now of the Arab Spring, they have funded, they have mobilized empires in information and media, and they have, in a sense, hijacked the uprising and hijacked it. Why? Because they feared a change that would affect their rules. So they didn't care very much for democracy. And what they have done proves that you will see, for example, the most active forces of change are Islamic fundamentalism, some religiously anchored groups with no history of democracy, human rights, and things like this. Now, at the regional level, plus the local level in some instances, many instances, and add to this at the international level, when you have the U.S. and the NATO forces, in the case of the U.S., it is motivated probably by two major concerns. One, not affecting their interest in controlling the governments where the source of energy, oil and gas, and things like this take place, mostly in the Gulf and elsewhere in Libya. We can see how they intervened in Libya to bring about a change and control things. So this was one objective. Another main objective, probably the most important one, is in, the Israeli interest. They looked at the change that is taking place, that it might affect the Palestinian position. It might strengthen this, what the conditions of the Palestinians in Israel, in occupied Palestine, is lamentable. And we know, notwithstanding so many resolutions of the Security Council and the General Assembly, Israel wouldn't withdraw. So these were the two motivations for the U.S. Now, what do we see? We see the U.S. side by side in the same trench with Al-Qaeda fighting against the Syrian regime. And why against the Syrian regime? The head, the opposition, the nationalist Syrian opposition, had it its way, as they said from the beginning, we are against resorting to arms, we are against foreign intervention, and we are against religious and sectarian incitement. And what is happening in Syria is the exact opposite of that. They have given a regime that they described, and probably rightly so, as brutal. They give the regime legitimacy to use force, because when you have fighters, when you have citizens carrying weapons and killing civilians and military, police, and destroying the national economy, bombing the gas lines, and committing basically terrorist acts, no government in the world could accept that. So we see this happening in Syria, and we see the U.S. in the same trench supporting fundamentalists coming from abroad, coming from Yemen, coming from Libya, coming from Saudi Arabia, coming from Shishan, coming from all over the world to fight in Syria. It is a very, very odd thing. Maybe the U.S. would feel that it can control this in the future, but what one should legitimately fear is that we might relive the experience of Afghanistan, where the U.S. has supported the Afghani resistance, Al-Qaeda at that time, to get rid of the Soviet Union, and then we know what happened. So I'm afraid that the U.S. might be repeating the same mistake here.
Well, that is definitely a whole different perspective on obviously what all our listeners and everybody has been talking about in the corporate media here. Professor Dawood, on the Gulf states like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, you talked about the Gulf states. So their support for the militarization of what's happening in Syria particularly, is that mainly to protect their own interests and their own presence in fear that this will get to their countries, but it's not much for the love of quote-unquote freedom for Syria and for the betterness of the Syrian people?
Could any reasonable man think that authoritarian rules like in Saudi Arabia or Qatar or other Gulf countries would be interested in participatory governments, in fundamental freedoms, in human rights. We know what happened to Bahrain. The Bahrainis didn't raise a kitchen knife. And we know how they were suppressed swiftly, and the role that Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries have played in suppressing the Bahraini uprising. There is no question in my mind that resorting to arms in Syria was for the main purpose of aborting a true democratic uprising that would lead, because the Syrian regime, if it is known for its brutality, we shouldn't give it an excuse to you to be brutal. If the uprising was totally peaceful, and the Syrians have put, the regime has put a million Syrians in jails without anyone have a pocket knife, what do you think? Would there be an officer in the army who wouldn't have reacted to this? The issue was just to make it bloody and raise sectarian feeling, justify foreign intervention so that the decision ultimately, when you have a foreign intervention, you don't talk about sovereignty. Foreign intervention makes the foreigners decide about your destiny. We know what happened in Iraq. We know what happened in Libya. We know what happened all over the world. So the aborting the uprising, aborting the reform process was, in my judgment, the main objective.
Now, you mentioned Israel and that it was also in Israel's interest what's happening in Syria to continue that militarization of the situation there. You referred to that it was afraid that this will affect the Palestinian position or will strengthen the Palestinian position. In one way, a lot of my friends and people, when we talk, they always talk about, well, Syria under the Syrian regime, it's described some kind of a protector for Israel, especially on its borders. And after all, Syria still has an occupied land by Israel, the Golan Heights, but somehow protected Israel on its borders big time since 1967 and was going kind of with the flow, although there were no formal peace treaties. So why would Israel get rid of such a regime in this case?
It is really sad to hear an American, an Arab intellectual, or American or any intellectual who knows the fact, who would really buy these things, buy this argument. Do we really believe that the Israelis are happy with the Syrians helping Hezbollah, helping Hamas, arming Hamas, and being the only country that has not signed a peace agreement with Israel? Do we really think that this is what Israel wants? It is obvious that Israel wanted to change the role of Syria. What role? The role of Syria as supporter of the resistance, supporter of Hezbollah, arming Hezbollah, supporter of the so-called rejection group. When we know that this has been the policy of these countries and Syria and its allies. And when we know when we read the Israeli press, when we listen carefully to their leaders, it is obvious that they are against the Syrian regime, and there is hardly any other Arab regime that still has an Arab discourse that cares for the Palestinian issue, that talks about the Palestinian issue. The whole uprising, the whole Arab Spring is the spring of Israeli desire to make the Arabs forget about the Palestinians. Do you hear anything about the Palestinians now?
Hardly. And also another point, Professor Dawood, Iran. Do you think what's happening and the this notion of the U.S. and the West and their intervention in Syria big time is to somehow plan for a future, whatever you want to call it, attack or whatever, to break the Iranian control over that area, or planning for possible military attack on Iran and so on to weaken that link in the Middle East?
Definitely, Israel would want a weakened Iran. a weakened Syria, a weakened Palestinian, a weakened resistance, a weakened neighbor, a weakened... It is the logical, the very simple equation governs the relation between occupier and occupied countries, occupied people. Every underdog, every occupied country, its people try to recover whatever rights they can. And every occupier, every oppressor would like to instill in the occupied the culture of surrender to the status quo, a culture of giving up. When the resistance, when it becomes a culture of the occupied, there is nothing that torments the occupier more than that. It's very simple, and it's all over the world. So for a long time, Israel has managed, since 48 until 2000, to spread the culture of surrender to the status quo, the culture of defeat. And as a result of that, they got two peace agreements, all kinds of accommodation, normalization with Israel and things like this. And they were going until 2000 when it was forced to leave Lebanese territories without any condition as a result of the resistance. Few months after that, the second Palestinian uprising in Jerusalem started. And that's when Israel started reconsidering. And that's when the Syrians, I remember very well, when they were in Lebanon, we used to ask the Americans and the officials, whether State Department or White House, please let the Syrians withdraw down to the Bekaa Valley. And they will tell us, the Syrians are elements of resistance, and are elements of peace in Lebanon. They are a guarantee for security and peace in Lebanon. Overnight, they became a threat to international peace and security, and the Security Council has adopted resolutions to oust them immediately, the 1559 resolution. What has happened then? Nothing on the part of the Syrians. They didn't do anything except that Israel felt that they want to disarm Hezbollah. They want to get rid of the culture of resistance and get rid of it totally.
And of course, you mentioned earlier, nobody talks about Palestine now and occupied Palestine where it's happening. But at the same time, Israel continues its daily atrocities, land confiscation, uprooting trees, demolishing Palestinian homes, settlement erections, and so on.
This is not the Arab Spring, this is the Israeli Spring.
And that's spring, fall, winter, you name it, constantly, all the time, for dozens of years. Last question, Dr. Dawood. What do you think should happen with the Arab uprising? How could this madness stop in Syria, for example?
I think in Syria, according to international law, according to common sense, according to national Syrian interest, people's desire, the Syrian solution, the solution to the Syrian problem should be Syrian made by the Syrian people. The opposition, the national opposition, should negotiate, should talk to the regime. No one would require that they accept anything that the regime proposes. But they have to have a clear vision of a way out. Destroying Syria, destroying Damascus and Aleppo, is this a way to liberate Syria? I mean, is there a Syrian nationalist who thinks that common sense, reason dictate this solution? This is the desire of foreign forces. Unfortunately, there are some foreign forces who have managed to make of Islam, instead of being a uniting factor, to make of Islam a means to destroy Arab and Islamic society. You know, imagine now the Sunni and the Shia are enemies, you know, and Israel is the friend. You know, the oppressors are Iran and Hezbollah, and you know, it's incredible how the media creates an image in the mind of the people that make them forget the reality as is and go after something fictitious, something flimsy, as we hear.
Absolutely interesting analysis of what is really happening there, analysis that our listeners don't hear from the corporate media.
That was a portion of an interview I conducted back in 2012 with Dr. Dawood Khairallah, who was an attorney and professor of international law at Georgetown University and the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Khairallah passed away on March 22, 2020, in Fairfax, Virginia. May he rest in peace. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and be healthy. People of Earth is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on Earth.